America. Tonight, we're going to talk a little bit about history. This book was written by a friend of mine. We talked about it last week. Trust me, if you're going to order it, you should order it at the beginning of the episode. I understand it's already 3 weeks out of print, so it's going to be... They're printing them as fast as they can. Chris Stewart is a guy who I read one of his other books on my last vacation. I think it was in January. And I actually called him while I was on vacation. I got yelled at by my wife. What are you doing? You're on vacation. I said, I have to talk to this guy. This is the best written history book I have ever read because he's a fantastic storyteller. And the stories that he tells in Miracle of Freedom, Seven Tipping Points That Saved the World, are the stories of how we got here and how we came this close to not being here. He left out the American Revolution, which I might argue with, but he says at the end of the book, and I'm not going to spoil it for you, but he says at the end of the book, I know there are more than seven tipping points, but these ones, these are remarkable. The defeat of the Assyrians, a story really I barely even knew. The end of this story is remarkable. The victory of the Greeks over the Persians, right? It was the Persians, yeah. Story of arrogance. Constantine coming to Rome and uniting the empire starts with a baby found in the trash. The defeat of Islam in France, where we had no reason to win. Christians had no reason to win against Islam in France, but they drew a line in the sand. The Mongols in Eastern Europe. When I heard John Kerry, do you remember when John Kerry testified and he said, "This is reminiscent of Genghis Khan." And I thought, who says Genghis except for somebody who's married to Teresa? But I knew that Genghis Khan was a bad guy. And I knew that he was, things that would later be quoted as reminiscent of would be very bad. But I had no idea. I think this guy made Adolf Hitler look like a rookie. Bad. We'll tell you this story a little bit tonight. 1492, an interesting story of absolutely no hope for the West, and suddenly new hope. 2 days before, was it 2 days before or 1 day before the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria went out? Does anybody know what happened in Spain? Just within 2 days before they set sail. Pretty significant. Pardon me? They were looking for a bailout. No, they weren't looking for a bailout. Yes? Rex? What?
Did they purge the Jews?
Yes, they purged the Jews. And I thought, my gosh, what a dark period. And then the next day, boats go out to start a new period of real enlightenment. It's amazing. And then 1940, a story of one man alone. Everyone called him crazy. And really, it was the turning point, and we saved the world because of one man in England. Let me introduce you to Chris Stewart. Chris, first of all, best written stories of history. You can't turn the pages fast enough. You bring it to life. Thank you for writing history this way.
You're overly kind, Glenn, but thank you.
Tell me about the defeat of the Assyrians. Who were the Assyrians and what happened?
You know, and that's one of my favorite stories in the book. Everyone always asks, what's your favorite story? And it's really impossible to choose just one of them. And think about this. In the entire history of the world, in the thousands of years that we are talking about, we've selected seven stories. And each of them are so compelling and so interesting, and they literally are these tipping points. So when people ask, well, let's start with this, or why is this interesting to you, I always feel like, well, what's my favorite child? It's
right.
Hard to choose. But before I answer your question, could I back up just a little bit?
Yeah.
And that is, this book is it's a story of freedom. It answers a question, as you were indicating, where does freedom come from? And it also makes a point that freedom is extraordinarily rare. In the whole history of the human race, scientists estimate that maybe 100 to 110 billion people have lived on this earth, maybe 125 billion, depending on who you talk to. And yet a tiny, tiny percentage of those people have experienced anything that we would consider free today.
Even China-style freedom looks good under what most people have experienced in the history of mankind.
And, you know, you indicated that here with the story of the child that was, you know, they just didn't value human life. We're talking about abject slavery. We're talking about torture, this constant fear of who will be our next leader. You know, our idea of freedom is, well, do I have enough gas to go down to Walmart and buy another Xbox? These people were dealing with, how do I survive another day?
Okay, let's do this differently then. I'm not going to start at the beginning. Let's just jump around because we're here. Let's start with the baby in the trash. What? Tell me about the baby in the trash.
Well, you know, that was about the time of Christ, and the Roman Empire was very, very powerful and considered a fairly progressive and fairly mild empire in the sense of how they treated those people that fell under their rule. And yet, they just simply didn't value human life the way we do today. And that's what we were hoping to illustrate with that part of the story, is that even with these fairly progressive empires, that they just didn't understand what you and I take for granted. And that is, a Roman soldier wrote to his wife in Alexandria, and he was saying she was about to give birth, and he said, if it's a son, keep him. But if it's a daughter, just throw him away. And, you know, it's impossible for you and I to imagine that, speaking of one of our children, a child that was going to be born. And yet it was fairly common at that time. They preferred the sons for very obvious reasons and didn't have much value in their daughters. And, you know, that's a great illustration about this was a very brutal time. And when I say this, I mean up until the modern day when we have this explosion of freedom, this golden age of freedom that we see around us now.
The story starts out, this chapter starts out with a little boy going to search for food in a trash heap on a barge or something, right?
Yeah.
On the river.
Yeah.
Or just outside of Rome. And starts to go through the trash heap because he's a Christian, and Christians at this point in Rome, not popular. So,
yeah,
what are you living like?
He was a Christian Jew, and as I don't think most people recognize, most of the early converts to Christianity were Jews. And they were not, of course, we know the Christians weren't treated very well in the Roman Empire.
And especially Christian Jews.
Yeah, that's
right.
Kind of a double
right.
Whammy there. And so they were doing what a lot of people did, and Rome was a fairly wealthy city, and like unfortunately today, they threw out a lot of food that would sustain people around the world, and so it was common for people to go through the garbage heaps and to be looking for food or anything of any value, actually. And in doing so, he came across what was not that unusual, an infant who had been thrown away and had survived a night and decided to take her home.
So he hears the cries of this baby as he's going through the trash heap, and he's putting apple peels into his pocket, and he hears the cries of a baby and picks him up. And you suddenly realize that he is totally unique in the culture, that the culture is set up to a point to where anybody else, a Roman citizen, would have left the baby just in the trash heap. It's not like you go to the police and say, hey, he then takes the baby and goes to his uncle,
yeah.
Who is Josephus.
Yeah.
Who is Josephus?
Well, and Josephus in this case isn't the Josephus that you
Oh, it's not. I thought it was.
In history, no. It's a character who would have lived sometime after that.
Okay.
But the whole point of this story is to illustrate, as you were saying, that this was a turning point in culture in the sense of for the first time, this Judeo-Christian idea that every person is a value. Including slaves, including those who are not free, including those who are not citizens. Every person has a value.
So then Constantine comes, and because he sees a cross in the sky, and he says, with this symbol, you will become the Caesar Augustus.
Under the
right?
Sign conquer.
Right.
And there's different interpretations, literal translations
right.
of what he saw, but that's essentially it. Under this sign conquer.
And the amazing battle that happens, he comes. Now remember, think of Rome as Rome, and it's a walled city, and it has a river. And you're not fighting. You're not going to fight Rome at the wall. And yet he marches his army up to the wall, and tell the rest of the story.
Well, and he had been bringing, it was a conflict between two men who wanted to be Caesar Augustus, the ultimate ruler of Rome. And had he had to lay siege to Rome, it would have been a very, very bloody battle that would have lasted perhaps for months or even longer. And yet the other emperor, who was his opponent, felt there was no question that he was going to win this battle. And
arrogance.
And he sent his forces out to destroy Constantine and his army. And he maneuvered in some tactical ways that would put him at a disadvantage, and much of his army was drowned, and the rest of it was defeated.
He comes out of the walled city, crosses the river, and says, "You're not going to destroy us." Constantine backs the army up. They fall in the river. They're slaughtered, and they drown in the river.
Yeah, including the emperor himself, fell off the bridge and was drowned in the river.
Amazing, amazing story. And it was that turning point. It was that moment that, I mean, we could argue about Constantine. I think Constantine was an interesting guy.
Yeah.
And you can argue about Constantine, whether he was good or bad. But it was a turning point from Christians being hunted, depending on who the emperor was, being persecuted, to all of a sudden, wait a minute, we're somebody.
Yeah.
And it was the turning point for Europe.
Yeah. And, Constantine was in what would consider late Middle Age at the time. He was in his 40s, spent his entire life as a pagan, and I think there was a conversion process that took place over several years.
My favorite is he didn't get baptized until his deathbed as emperor. This is my favorite quote, and I'm butchering it. I don't know if you know this quote because it's not in the book, but he said something along the lines of, "As emperor, there are things I have to do. Baptize me when I'm dying."
Yeah.
He wanted the forgiveness for all the crap he had to do. Save it. I've got bad stuff I got to do.
That's covering your bases.
Yeah.
But, whether he was truly converted or the process through which he was converted, whether it was instantly or over years or what was in his heart, it doesn't matter. The thing that's important
started the ball rolling.
That's right. Is for the first time the Romans accepted Christianity instead of persecuting them, and that very quickly a large percentage of the Roman Empire became Christian.
I was really struck by. I mean, again, the point of the book, at least that I got, was there's no way man should be free. Everything is set up against man being free. There's no way that we're free today. All of these things, and these are just seven that you point out, none of these things should have happened.
Yeah.
It shouldn't have fallen that way. But they did. It was that point, and also, no place, maybe Somalia, some places in the Middle East, they know what horror shows are, but very few in the world really understand what real horror shows are.
Yeah, it's so outside of our normal experience. Even things that we can read or see on television.
Right. But that was the norm.
Yeah.
Right?
Until what time? Well, probably the last few generations. I mean, here's some interesting numbers. There's only 22 nations that have experienced democracy today for greater than 50 years. We talked about 100 to 110 billion people have lived in this earth. Only 5 billion of them have ever experienced what we consider freedom, and 3 billion of them are alive today. So this idea of freedom, and we look around us and we say, well, this is the way things are, this is the way things have always been, is simply not true. It's something that is a modern experience. It's a modern, even up through Soviet Union or Communist China, I mean, enormous numbers of people who in a very recent time didn't experience what we take for granted all the time.
When we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit about Genghis Khan.
Or Genghis Khan, which one?
Genghis.
Yeah.
If he had modern technology, worse than Mao and Hitler and Stalin?
Yeah, I just think...
And horrible.
When you read, and we can talk about that, but there was...
Yeah, when we come back, things that I don't think people really... we haven't seen before. My daughter and I, it's funny, we had a horror off in history.
Just the other day, I finished reading. I said, "Do you know about Genghis Khan?" And she started telling me, or I started telling her a little bit, and she said, "Oh, Dad, Vlad the Impaler did X, Y, and Z." And I said, "No, honey, listen to this, this, and this." And she's like, "Dad, how about this guy?" I mean, it's a very strange, sick, sad family. But we'll be back in just a second. We're back with Chris Stewart, the author of The Seven Tipping Points That Save the World. It is a fantastic book on history and one that I think every American should read. It is one that you should own and read because it gives you some concept of how odd our life really is. Unless I was a feudal lord, I wouldn't have had this. Things are not what you... They haven't been homogenized by Disney. Genghis Khan, tell a story about what he used to do to walled cities and how he used to get in.
Well, you know, there's a couple ways you can breach a barrier. You could build a catapult, you could build a ramp, or you could do what he did, and that was you took slaves or captured citizens and you would kill them and then pile their bodies up. And found out that that was a pretty nifty way to breach a wall as well, is just pile up the people you'd captured and killed.
So if you have a wall, he'd just take captives, start piling their bodies up until he made a ramp, and then he would march his army up
the ramp.
The ramp of dead bodies. I was struck by, you know, we talk about people now, you're using children as human shields. This guy did it and didn't care what anybody said.
Yeah, he took it to a whole other level. You know, there's a scene in there where they're attacking an empire and, the capital of this kingdom. And as the horses are riding towards them, they put rags around their feet to muffle the sound of their approach. And it makes it a little disorienting for the soldiers because they don't know from what direction all of them are coming. And they're looking through the dust and you can see something before them as they're driving their horses forward. And then they realize their archers are about ready to attack. And they realize they're driving children from other cities around the capital there before the army, and they would use these children as you said, human shields. Sometimes they would tie them to their saddles and hold them in front of them so that the archers, what do you do then if you've got these children out there in the middle of this battle that have been driven before the Mongols? Do you dare fire your arrows or do you hold back? And again, the confusion and the hesitation it would cause, it's a very evil but probably an effective tactic.
Genghis Khan went up. I mean, the Mongols, they swept everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, give an idea of how big that turned into.
Well, you know, and it is, that's a great point, because at one point he controlled more territory, in fact, twice as much territory as any other single man. In 25 years, the Mongols had captured and controlled more territory than the Romans did in 400 years. I mean, they reached from India and Cambodia on the east, all through Central and Southwestern Asia, through the Middle East. And reaching into Eastern Europe, it was an enormous swath of land that
went
they had
in. The Mongols went in and just killed. Was it Kiev?
Yeah.
It just went in and just killed everybody.
Yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken, it was a few years later.
Yeah, 12 years later, it was nothing but a village of a few hundred people. I mean, and that's one of the things that he did that had very long-lasting and 700-800 years of impact. That there were entire cultures that we don't know about because there's nothing left. Virtually everyone was killed.
I wish I would have brought it to the set today. Didn't realize we would go down this conversation. I was sent a book today on Moses. I showed it to you, didn't I?
Yeah.
I showed it to you.
Yep.
This is the most beautiful book I've ever seen on Moses. It is just a few words at the bottom of each page, but these beautiful pieces of art on each page that tell the story of Moses. What's interesting about it was printed in Berlin in 1925. It's all in German. And it has a name on the cover, and I'm trying to find who owned this book and what the story of this book was. It was given to me, and it was given to me with a note that said, "Very few remain." Because that's exactly what Hitler tried to do. Just But in those days, Genghis Khan did it. Just erased entire towns, yeah. entire populations, killed every man, woman, and child, yeah. and did it to scare the next town.
Yeah. And you know, there's a great story about Kiev where the governor or the mayor essentially, Genghis was going to let him get by with paying a tithe, pay 10%. And he says, you can take it once we're dead. And he said, okay. And came in and just it destroyed the entire city. As I said, a few years later, there's only a few hundred people who live there. And it's taken generations for some areas of the world to recover from that. And in some ways, some of them haven't. There's a sense of submission in some of the locations.
You make the point that some parts in Russia, the reason why they have been with the czars and yeah. then with Stalin, and they still go back under yeah. Putin and everything else, is because of Genghis Khan or the Mongols.
They were conditioned by that. The Russian Christian Church essentially said, you know, if we're faced with destruction or allowing you to come in and subjecting ourselves to you, we'll do that. And so they encouraged their people to be subjects to Genghis Khan. And as a result of that, they were working in concert with him to some level. And that's something that you can see through subsequent generations, why they were willing to live under the czars and submit themselves to the czars or to the communist regimes. Many historians trace that back to that original conditioning by...
I'm struck not only by the fragility of freedom and how rare it is, but I'm also really struck in each story by, wow, this feels like a tipping point that yeah. we're at. Do you believe we're at an eighth tipping point?
The eighth tipping point. You know, I don't know how we can't be. When you look at the clash of cultures, and I mean not just internally here within our own country, within the United States, but clash of cultures around the world. When you look at the public discourse that we see, we could talk about lots of different things. The monetary and fiscal policies that have the potential literally to destroy this nation. When you look at some of the political or cultural issues. And then when you look at the threats that that we are going to face or our children are going to face, it seems to me like it's certainly a tipping point.
When we come back, I want to take a break. And when we come back, I want to start here. Progressives believe, and no judgment here, but the progressive ideology is based in man progresses and gets better. And we learn and we evolve. And, I mean, it really is tied to evolution. We evolve and we just get better. Our founders believed that the natural man is an enemy to God and an enemy to freedom. He gets a little bit of power and he will just run. I want to start there on just what does history tell us on which one is right? Do we progress or is the natural man an enemy of God? Back in a second. We're back with Chris Stewart, author of Seven Tipping Points That Saved the World. It is, I think, the best written history book. You know what? I shouldn't say that because you are going to get so much crap from everybody. It's horrible. If you're a pointy little egg-headed freak at a university, well, I'm a history professor and I've written all these books that nobody has read.
Yeah.
There's a reason for that. Really, really well written. You learn history through the weaving of a great, great story. Seven Tipping Points for Freedom. And when we went into the break, what I set up was, which one is right? Progressives who believe that men learn and get better and we progress, or I think what is common sense, man never learns a damn thing as a group. We keep repeating the same mistakes. And you've got to shackle men as much as you can in positions of power because the bad guys will always grow, which yeah. is right.
You know, history seems to indicate that we're not very good at policing ourselves, that men come to power, and once they have power, as we've talked about so many times here, that tyranny rules. And that's why, you know, this thing, this democracy, this republic, the United States, that is a recent phenomenon when compared with the history of the world. That's why this is such a miracle. That's why this is so astounding, because for the first time we broke that mold.
Jim, your question on this.
This started with your 40-day and 40-night challenge. I started reading the Bible on a regular basis, and out of that I drew questions. In the book of Psalms, we're taught that you can't put your faith in man to rule. He becomes corrupt. And in Daniel, it tells you that eventually God will destroy all the kingdoms on earth and establish his own kingdom and government.
Yeah.
So can we as man rule ourselves, or do you believe in the American exceptionalism if it says in the Bible that we can't?
No. Man can rule himself. Men? No, not so much. That's what the founders knew. The founders knew that man, I put my faith. Somebody said to me, I had lunch with somebody today, and they said, Glenn, you're so pessimistic on the American people. And I said, what makes you think that? I believe in the American people every time. I'll put my faith in you and you and the business down the street. I'll put my faith in them every time. Huge, giant global corporations or giant global governments? No, not so much. No, I won't. Because they want to rule over. I want to rule myself. You rule yourself. That's the difference. Is can we create a system that gives you the maximum power to rule yourself and the maximum limitation on someone who wants to rule over you? Because only God can set up a kingdom that is truly just. You know, I love this stuff about social justice. This garbage about social justice. There's no such thing. There can be equal justice. We can strive for equal justice here. But there's only one great power that will even everything out. Maura, your question.
I think that we really are at a tipping point with what's happening with Israel. And I don't think our administration, current administration, respects what the will of the people is. So I'm wondering, how do we stop them from betraying our friends in Israel? How do we let them know that we do stand with them?
I personally have an answer. I want you to kind of go to the defeat of the Assyrians here in a second. My answer is, again, man must rule himself. You have to make the personal choice to stand and be seen standing and let people in Israel know. If there's enough people that stand up as individuals, our governments will fail us every time. They always have. So why are we waiting for them? Why are we looking at them and saying, well, we should change their mind, we should change their course? Forget about them. Stand up. Because in the end, you're not going to have the excuse, well, the government did it. Well, I was just obeying orders. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's the individual that makes the difference. You tell about, because this gives me real hope. Listen to the end of this story of the Assyrians being defeated.
Okay, and could I make a comment on the previous question? I'd like to tie two things that were said there. One of them is the idea of American exceptionalism, and the other is, will we stand with Israel? I absolutely believe in this idea of American exceptionalism, and I'd like to point out that we are not the only people who feel that way. A few years ago, I was in Morocco, had an opportunity to go to one of the most poverty-ridden, anti-American, anti-Western neighborhoods maybe in the world. And felt fairly uncomfortable there. And as I'm walking down this little alley, and these alcoves built into the side of the hill where there'd be little shop owners, and the little man standing there guarding his money box, and behind him is a poster written in English, which catches my eye. And it's the Gettysburg Address. And I read that, and I'm astounded. What is that here? And he and I look at each other, and he kind of smiles to me. And I realize that, yeah, we believe in American exceptionalism. We believe that we have a special role in the world. But there are tens of millions of people around the world who believe the same thing. They hope the same thing. They want that to be true because they know that their best hope of living under any sort of democracy or freedom or greater economic freedom will come because of our efforts. And I think by extension that applies to our stand with Israel as well.
Hang on just a second. With our understanding and living the true principles behind the Gettysburg Address And again, I believe the individuals doing it. Not because we're responsible for a lot of oppression, too. I'm sorry, but I don't believe in ghost planes. I don't believe in picking people up and saying, hey, we're going to drop you off in Egypt unless you talk to us now. No. If we're going to torture somebody, we torture them.
Yeah.
Be the monster. Don't allow someone else to be the monster. And if you don't want to be the monster, don't allow anybody else to be it either.
Yeah. Well, and that's a fair point, and I wouldn't argue with that. But my, the point I was trying to make there is that there are people in that area who want us to make
yes.
that stand. They recognize that we bring stability,
yes.
that we bring a potential for them bettering their lives by us being
there. There's the same reason there's a lot of Palestinians that stand with Israel. There's the Palestinian situation in Jerusalem works.
Yeah.
It works.
Yep, and they don't want that thing taken away.
Right.
They don't want that thing destroyed either.
All right, so let me go back to your answer on Israel here, and where I found great, great hope with the defeat of the Assyrians. We are going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back. Back with author Chris Stewart. He's also, he's such an overachiever. He is also an Air Force pilot. You hold some records, fastest speed around the world or something?
Fastest nonstop flight around the world.
I mean, just what? Just for your... Just
why not?
Just for your... a good friend of mine and an amazingly decent man.
You don't know me very well, Glenn.
No, yes, I do. And you're a decent man and a brave man. Let me go to the defeat of the Assyrians.
Yeah.
First, who are the Assyrians and who were they fighting?
Well, the Assyrians were at the time, 700 BC, the most powerful. And we were talking about brutality. They were one of the most brutal empires ever in ancient history. And they had this war with the kingdom of Judah in the southern and northern kingdoms. And it was very important to them because the kingdom of Judah controlled this land bridge between the Assyrians and this other rising empire, the Egyptians. And they set out to destroy them.
And Judah at the point, this is the southern part of Israel, Judah is a speed bump to the Assyrians. The Assyrians are the United States of America, and they're Yemen.
Yeah.
Judah is Yemen. It's a speed bump to make sure that they get to Egypt and crush that forming power of Egypt.
Yeah, and in fact, they had already crushed the northern kingdom and dispersed them. Thus, we have the lost 10 tribes that so many people know about. And they come into the kingdom and they destroyed all of the major cities, Lachish and others, and they had Jerusalem yet to go. And they laid siege upon Jerusalem. And at the time, there was a prophet in the Old Testament who was advising the king. And he assured him that God would intervene and save them. And the Assyrians were pretty good historians, and they have depictions of this battle. And although they don't say why, there was a significant part of their army that was probably taken with the plague, is what they say, 180,000 of them in a matter of a few days. The Bible depicts it as they were destroyed by an angel of God. There's different interpretations of all that,
sure.
Of course, if you want a literal or more religious interpretation. But the bottom line is that the Assyrians turned around and went back to Babylon.
So here they go. So the Assyrian king is, and you describe it so beautifully, the Assyrian king is like, you've got to be kidding me. I've destroyed everybody. They're going to stand against me? Some crazy man says that God's going to save them? I've killed all of them. Go and kill every man, woman, and child. Sends this enormous army. How big was the army of Judah?
Well, it was very, very small.
Because it was actually inside
within the
walls of Jerusalem.
Walls of Jerusalem, which was
right.
A few miles across at that point.
If you've ever been to Jerusalem, it ain't a big city. So they've got everybody in there. 180,000 come to destroy them. And mysteriously, like you said, we don't know what happened. But they all get sick.
Yeah.
And they get sick. And they're, who knows? But they can't fight. They cannot fight.
And the tipping point was so important there, and that is this. Had the kingdom of Judah been destroyed, there would have been no seedbed for Christianity in which it could have been placed and could have thrived. And it was so important for Christianity in order for us to develop Western values, Western civilization as we know it now was...
You really understand in your book the importance of the Jewish culture and the importance of the Christian culture to the West. If it wasn't for those two cultures, freedom may not have been had yet.
They were both so important. And, you know, we look back and there wasn't one event where, boing, this happened and now freedom in the latter age is guaranteed. These were all very painful, they took place over a long period of time, and yet each of them was critical to development of this freedom.
So here's the answer to your question. I think we are at a tipping point, and I think Israel is, it is, if you look at it, forget about all the religious stuff, forget about even humanity. Look what has happened to Jews, 1492, and before that, Assyrians. Look through history. Always somebody's trying to kill them and wipe them out. So let's forget about the promise that we all made to ourselves that we would never forget, never let it happen again. Let's just be selfish and say we like our televisions and we like our cars and our way of life. If you pull Israel out of the Middle East, you're a military man, you pull that out of the Middle East at this point, what happens to the Middle East and the rest of the world?
Well, and it's a game changer, isn't it? It's so important for us to defend our ally and the only democracy in that part of the world.
And our troops, quite honestly, if you look at the map now and you see what's happening to us, our troops are surrounded. Our troops are now surrounded. And we are a wobbling country and force in the world. Everybody who's been trying to topple us forever has got to be licking their chops right now going, we could push them over. If you pull Israel out and America can't stand with it, well, then that emboldens everybody around the world in saying, my gosh, the era is over and the tipping point. Good news is, I firmly believe, Jim, you said a year ago you went to 828, and I challenged you, 40-day and 40-night challenge, right? Or you took the 40-day and 40-night challenge, right? And when you took that, what is the challenge? What did I say? Where did that challenge start?
The challenge for me started with, the biggest part of the challenge is pray every day.
Okay.
And along with the prayer, came read the Bible and learn the Bible.
Okay. It actually started, however, with firm reliance on divine providence. You have that now. Firm reliance of divine providence. Defeat of the Assyrians with divine providence. It will happen again. Watch. Back with Chris Stewart, the author of 7 Tipping Points That Saved the World. I can't recommend this book highly enough to you, especially because of the ending, which I want to highlight just a little bit of. But first, let me go to Rex.
We're so aware, thanks to shows like yours and great books like this, of so many things that are going on. Were these people aware back then of the tipping points, that they were in such a point in history?
You know, it's hard for us to project why they did what they did. I think in some cases they probably didn't view it as a tipping point. They were simply fighting to survive. They were fighting to continue with their culture or their people. But there were other times when I think they did view this as we have written up there, a line in the sand. And I think that the battle in France against the Islamic invasion is an example of that. There wasn't entirely just the idea that we need to stop this invasion so we can protect our homes. I think they viewed that as a clash between the cultures there, and they wanted to preserve Christianity.
Can you make the point that you made, you make at the end of the book? Because I have to tell you, I brought it into work, and I gave it to somebody, and I said, oh, I just want you to read this. I just want you to read these 5 pages. The end of the book is... We have a choice. Freedom is fragile, and you have to choose.
Yeah, you know it's fragile. As we've talked about, it's rare and it's precious, and it's not assured. We have to be willing to take the stand to stand up as they have throughout history, to pay the price and to be engaged in the fight in order to assure. I think most of us look at our children or grandchildren. I had my first grandchild a few weeks ago.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. And
Grandpa.
Grandpa. And it took me a while to get used to that. I look at what his, and imagine what his life is going to be. And most of us think, well, he's going to grow up like I did, in the security of living in a free land and knowing that it will always be that way.
Hold on. How many people here believe that our grandchildren will live like we do? Look at that. How many people, if I would have asked you that 5 to 8 years ago, would have said yes?
Yeah.
Look at
yeah.
that.
And I'm grateful that people recognize that, because if we just assume that it will always be this way, then we don't hear the call to arms that we need to stand up and be willing to protect it.
Okay. I want you to pick this book up and read it, because it will change your perspective, and it will do so in a way that, I mean, my eyes were truly, truly opened on how, you think you know how bad it could be? No. You don't know how good you have it, even the worst of us. You don't know how good you have it until you've read history. Back in just a second. Author of Seven Tipping Points That Saved the World. Not a professional historian, as I said to him in the break, but professional historians, well, the reason why nobody knows history, they stink on ice. grab this book. Next week, only 4 shows of this broadcast remaining. Final show of the Glenn Beck program on Fox is next Thursday. Don't miss an episode from New York. Good night, everyone.